This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Our town is burning, never returning. Nowhere to go, no home. Old church, old school, old trees. In photographs, in my mind. In my mind, my mind, in my mind.
Silicon dreams and carbon nightmares, the wide boundary impacts of AI, a hair-raising interview journey through developing dark futures. Bees, birds, and people as fodder for the system, while climate change is accelerated by corporate artificial intelligence. This hair-raising interview features Dr. Nate Higgins, director of the Institute for the Study of Energy and Our Future, talking with American social philosopher Daniel Schmachtenberger. Buckle up.
You're listening to The Great Simplification. I'm Nate Higgins. On this show, we describe how energy, the economy, the environment, and human behavior all fit together and what it might mean for our future. By sharing insights from global thinkers, we hope to inform and inspire more humans to play emergent roles in the coming great simplification. I would like to welcome my colleague Daniel Schmachtenberger back to the program to take a deep dive on artificial intelligence's potential impact on the environment and particularly climate change. I have recently gone to some energy tech climate conferences where AI is in every other presentation, at least, talking about how it's going to reduce emissions and be a general boon for the environment. My gut and my conversations with Daniel, Tristan Harris, and others tells me this is not likely the case. This conversation is a follow-up to our original one on AI and the superorganism. This was a deeply informative and oftentimes disturbing conversation, especially the 20-minute in the beginning before we got to AI and climate. I was talking about the broader macro story of artificial intelligence, human power systems, and what's happening, and some worst-case scenarios. So you be warned that the first 20 minutes are kind of intense. Since I met him 3 or 4 years ago, he's been very accurate on artificial intelligence and what's unfolding in our society with respect to AI. I think we're going to run into energy and other limits before what he suggests in this podcast manifests, but I defer to him on this topic. One final note is we keep this conversation at a high conceptual level, but his team has created a 20-plus page document of references, resources with actual data on what's going on the ground. We will update that in the show notes on YouTube and on the greatsimplification.com website, so you can look there for further data. The conversation continues, my friends. Please welcome Daniel Schmachtenberger. Hello, Daniel. Great to see you.
Good to see you, Nate.
Of the 100-odd topics that you and I could discuss relevant to human futures and in service of life, we're going to talk about artificial intelligence today. And even on that topic, there are many, many subsets, how it affects inequality, profits and power and military and corporate, different new technologies. But today, we are going to focus on what AI portends for climate change and the environment, because I don't think it's often discussed. So I just got back from a climate energy tech conference where many of the people presenting were offering this or that technology that was going to be better for climate because it was using artificial intelligence. So I know you and your colleagues, your team, have been working on addressing this question. Why don't we start by giving an overview of how artificial intelligence in its current form could be good for the environment in theory? What are the main threads from there?
Sure. There's a pretty comprehensive paper. Let me see the name. Tackling Climate Change with Machine Learning, that was written last year, that addresses pretty much all of the claims of how AI, machine learning, and, you know, the associated sensors and automation could help. And it's everything from being able to model natural phenomena better, like being able to model how icebergs are melting better to predict rates and things like that, to modeling atmospheric dynamics better for being able to do aerosol-based geoengineering more effectively, to being able to create efficiency gains in lots of areas that supposedly should create a decrease in energy or material use because of the efficiency gains. And then the really big areas are the idea of AI being able to help fundamental scientific and technological breakthroughs, things like nuclear fusion in particular, and energy generation, energy storage, way better batteries, you know, things like that. But, you know, nuclear fusion, room temperature superconductors, those are kind of holy grail claims. But if you look at all of the areas where efficiency could be applied, if you think about all the places where you've got oil lines or natural gas lines, the ability to have sensors all along them that monitors a leak and that can, you know, use some kind of machine intelligence to be able to identify where the leaks are happening. And then at minimum to direct people there, but pretty soon to kind of have automated robotic servicing of it happening, obviously you'll have less leaks. So there are lots of areas where if you're applying optimization to an efficiency problem, you'll get some gains.
And how many of those are theoretical and how many of those have you seen evidence that are actually manifesting already to some small or greater degree?
The things that I think are for certain possible is wherever we're talking about sensors where there's lots of data and you need AI to be able to model all of that data, that's straightforward. Like that type of technology exists, is getting better. Ironically, one of the major applications of it is to make the extraction of oil cheaper and more efficient. And so, you know, 92% of all oil companies are in major contracts with AI companies to develop their oil and fossil fuel extraction using AI techniques, everything from like super technologically advanced stuff, like being able to use AI on seismic records and underground acoustics to be able to see exactly where the underground resources are and stuff like that, to be able to make the exploration and exploitation costs much cheaper. All the big AI companies are servicing that industry. NVIDIA is providing chips and working with, you know, big traditional energy and not on the, just the renewable side. And Microsoft services has whole contracts and products developed exclusively for oil industry, things like that. But I would say those types of things, excuse me, where we're looking at lots of data and the ability to make sense of that, that's a pretty solid thing. Where we're looking at also kind of marginal efficiency gains that don't require fundamental breakthroughs, that's going to happen. Where we're talking about fundamental breakthroughs, so the way Gates said it, I think, is kind of clear. He's like, the types of AIs we have so far as material innovation, tech innovation, speed up stuff that humans are already doing pretty well with, but they're not doing the types of things we're really interested in that humans aren't making much progress with. And so if you think about like AI has been used in nuclear energy and fission for a long time to help both with stability of the fission centers and things like that. And it's the breakthroughs in that space have been marginal. Things like, will it really create massive breakthroughs in the speed to fusion or things like that? Those, I would say there is no, we can see why people think maybe, but there's no precedent for high confidence, particularly on any timeline for those things.
I don't know about you, but when I look at LinkedIn and I talk to people, not in my core circle, but in the broader people paying attention to the world, I think the consensus is that AI is going to be good for the environment because of many of the things that you said. It's going to make renewable technology and batteries and clean tech more efficient. And on a narrow boundary view, which you and I don't specifically use, we like to look at a wider boundary, and we're going to get to that in a second. It's positive for using less energy and materials. Would you agree?
I think that is a popular narrative. I think that there are a lot of people in the environmental space and the climate space who don't think that's true. But I think there's a lot of people who are broadly concerned about environment and climate, don't understand it in great detail. And I think there's a bunch of reasons to kind of buy that narrative. Obviously, from a marketing perspective, if I've got a product or service, then I look at all of the various market sectors and try to figure out how to market to them and why my thing will be useful to them. So AI and defense is one of the biggest topics. And it's kind of like there actually is no defense conversation that is not AI and defense right now. It's AI for not just like autonomous weapons and drones, but it's also the precision targeting is AI. Also, increasingly, comprehensive battle planning is happening on more complex AI systems. Intelligence gathering of huge amounts of intelligence that people have to sort through is not that useful, right? It's only useful with AI systems. And so similarly, if I want to talk about law enforcement, AI can actually show you where the bad guys are because now we can actually make sense of all of this data. Does that look like AI-empowered, ubiquitous digital technological surveillance? Yeah, which is pretty bad. But if you look at pretty much every sector, right, AI is going to radically improve education because now we can have these AI tutors that know everything. They get to tutor your kids directly. And AI is going to help old folks' homes because now you get to have these chatbots to talk with the old people so they aren't lonely. And it's going to improve medicine. So the idea that AI is going to radically improve climate change, like, okay, so climate is an influential topic. It affects international policy. It affects national policy. So we got to get those guys to think this is a good thing. And so let's talk about all the ways that it's going to help. So from a supply side marketing to important demographics perspective, of course, there's going to be a lot of resource that goes into that. And that's spin. Now, when you look at just the rise of NVIDIA's market cap and associatedly everybody who's working in AI. So, you know, you look at the top 10 companies by market cap right now, and they're all AI companies. So Apple's not an AI company. Microsoft's not an AI company exclusively, but fundamentally, like that's one of their, if not their primary plays right now. Arguably, you could say the only one that is in the top 10 right now that isn't is like Saudi Aramco, but increasingly they're using their money from oil to fund AI efforts massively, and they're using AI to fund their, to advance their oil efforts. So obviously this is new, like that they're all AI companies. It was oil and defense and banking. That market sector being as big as it is and those companies being as powerful as they are means that there's a lot of marketing and a lot of lobbying and a lot of public influence. We, Consilience Project, we wrote a paper one time called Where Arguments Come From. And it was basically like the think tank industrial complex, you know, et cetera, kind of conversation of, so there's an argument circulating all over the place that that was not a natural selection of good ideas. Good ideas don't get naturally selected. They get upregulated by whoever it is that has marketing budgets to get that idea out a lot and to be able to pay research firms to develop the research they want and authors and, you know, et cetera. So the where arguments come from thing is really important to think about. And of course, if we're saying, okay, well, what about the environmentalists that are concerned about how much AI is actually going to radically damage the environment? Do they have comparable marketing budgets? And do they have like the correlation of force and means between those is as bad as it could be? It's kind of like peace activists compared to the military industrial complex correlation of force and means. There's another reason that people want to believe it is not just that they're being sold at like crazy, but a couple of reasons. One is it's kind of where all the money is happening, right? If I want to get ahead and at minimum not be left behind, I don't want to be against the thing that I can't stop and everybody who's riding is going to get ahead and everyone who's not is going to be left behind. So I would like to believe that riding that thing is good and maybe I can steer it in a good direction. And that's why even in the just not AI and climate, just AI space, there's this joke in the AI safety community that the fastest way to accelerate AI risk is starting an AI safety org. Because you know, OpenAI was started as an AI safety org to try to protect the world against the dangers of DeepMind, and now it is radically accelerating. Then Anthropic left because they were scared of its acceleration, wanted to make a safety org. But then they're like, hey, in order to be able to really test our tech, we have to build tech, which means we need a lot of money. So they took $300 million from Google, and now they're racing. And then Ilias left because he was concerned, and now he's got a company focused on superintelligence. And having privately talked with, you know, many people in the space, in addition to whatever their other concerns are, one of them is my job will be automated by AI soon. Right now, all of my friends who aren't working in AI safety and are working in AI development are making boatloads of money. They make their own little startup and get acquired for a stupid amount by one of the big ones. It does some nothing. It doesn't even matter what it is, like AI applied to. I have a brilliant, brilliant friend who's basically doing AI image recognition applied to taking certain kinds of files and putting them online with like a couple percent more efficiency than the previous type of image recognition. And he's like, I can get acquired for like a tremendous amount of money for something I can build in a couple of years. And I'm probably not ever going to be able to have a job in the future. And so that's another reason to want to be on board with the like AI is good story. And then the other one is that if you really care about climate change, you're probably pretty depressed. And the hope doesn't look that good, and any kind of hope. So why is the Jesus is going to come save us all narrative compelling for some people? Why is the maybe the UAPs that we're seeing are benevolent aliens and they'll save us all compelling? AI is another version of that. Like there's no good sign that the answer is going to come from us. We seem pretty intractably maybe something radically smarter than us can solve all the stuff, which is, of course, kind of like a regress to a childhood psyche still wanting a parent who's going to kind of figure it out. So AI does a very believable job of that currently for some people.
Just listening to that brief summary that you just gave, it really sounds like a Twilight Zone episode, like science fiction that would have been written 30, 40 years ago. And yet this is our world that we're living right now.
So wait, just real quick, in terms of the sci-fi episode, we had somebody put a clip together of things that people who are like running the top AI labs publicly have said. You clip it together and like many people have probably seen where Sam Altman, you know, has said several times on stage, AI will probably kill everyone, but it'll make a bunch of really profitable companies first. And everybody laughs and invests and the market cap goes up. And then like, you know, Elon said many things on this topic, but one of the clips recently was him saying, I used to be kind of bummed out by this, like AI will probably kill everything. But then I thought to myself, would I like to be here to see the AI apocalypse, or would I not like to be here? And I guess I'd like to be here to see it. You know, these are the people who are building the most powerful AI systems in the world. And the argument is we can't stop it because of races. If we can't stop everybody, then whoever gets to kind of AGI dominance first will run everything forever. And so if you feel like you could participate in that game and you think about it this way, there is only one game. There's only one game, which is be the leader of or a part of the group that makes it to AGI supremacy first. So one, if you can't stop it, every attempt to try to stop it is futile. It sounds a lot like the Borg or like Saruman saying to Gandalf, like, it's inevitable, you must join Sauron. Like, it has that kind of feeling, and you mentioned sci-fi. But so you hold this inevitability argument. And so now the fact that I'm not trying to stop it isn't an ethical issue because couldn't anyways, right? And then this is one of the most fascinating motivated reasoning cases. Actually, I have never seen motivated reasoning this that like captured this many smart people this intensely, this quickly. It is the superlative case of motivated reasoning in my life experience, where everybody who ends up saying, I need to run an AI company based on this argument says, the emergence of AGI is now inevitable. We don't even need major breakthroughs in cognitive architectures. We're going to get there just by scaling the stuff we have. Nobody could stop it because you can't stop everybody. You can't stop China, whatever. And it will probably be dystopic. Maybe kill all hydrocarbon life, like quite likely. In which case, if I get there first and it becomes totally out of control, it doesn't really, I'm not safer. But if there's any chance that whoever gets there first still kind of controls it or can merge with it, which is why, you know, Neuralink, brain-computer interface, Elon is working on that, Google's working on it, like almost all of the kind of big players are working on. And you'll hear Nick Bostrom say publicly recently, there are lots of reasons to prefer to be digital than biological. Biological things die and suffer and are limited and et cetera and are only work on this planet, and AI things can work in space and be eternal and become digital gods. And Ted Chu, who was the previous head of the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, was also the chief economist of GM for a while, wrote this book called Transhumanism and Human Potential, and basically said there's this kind of religious narrative of humans ascending into angels or higher selves or overmens or gods or something like that, and AI and synthetic bio and brain computer interface is what actually delivers that, where we can do whole brain emulation and upload our consciousness onto the cloud and move from being slime-based computational systems to crystalline-based computational systems that can live forever and et cetera. So that wackadoodle metaphysical idea is pretty universal and dominant in the AI acceleration space. And as a result, if somebody holds that that consciousness and life are purely the results of computation, that, you know, universe happened for who knows why, Big Bang, why are the constants what they are, who knows. Eventually on this earth, life started to emerge somehow. And then somewhere after life, around neural network, something called consciousness emerged. And it emerged because of a complexity of computational process that's happening in neurons and whatever. And it's because this hydrocarbon thing can do computation. That's the kind of computational neuroscience models that everything that is happening in the body that matters is to support the brain, and everything that's happening in the brain is basically to support computations. And that it's computation running on this hydrocarbon, i.e. slime-based computational substrate. And that as soon as we get adequately complex computational substrates on silica, you can run the same thing. But that the evolutionary process, David Pearce is probably the guy that has done more on this than anybody. David Pearce at Oxford and Nick Bostrom created the transhumanism movement together. And David Pearce has something called the abolitionist project, which is that the moral imperative for humanity is to abolish the potential for pain and suffering from the entire universe by genetically engineering opioid receptors out of humans that could experience pain, and not just humans, but all animals and all life, genetically engineering predation out of universe, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, once we can get past genetically engineering us to just being computational beings, that's the ideal. And he says evolution selected for us to be to survive, which meant lots of suffering motivations, not to be happy or whatever. We can do a better job now. So if you hold that biology, life, is basically just the happenstance that was able to bootload itself on this planet, right? And Elon has said hydrocarbon life is probably the bootloader for silica life. It loaded first to be able to evolve to the human place, to be able to make the silica system that will then take all the hydrocarbon life's atoms and repurpose it into the silica system. That's what it means that it's the bootloader. Because silica didn't automatically self-organize on the surface of the earth, but hydrocarbons did, and they figured out how to make the silica thing, and then the silica will use all the atoms to make the thing it wants to make. The idea that we're the bootloader, but that's awesome because the hydrocarbon things basically just suffer and are very limited and have cognitive biases and are emotional and are kind of nasty and are limited to this planet, which is going to be, but the AI systems can go interplanetary and, you know, be digital gods. You don't care about killing all life. It's a moral imperative to kill this thing and replace it with that other thing, right? So that kind of terrestrial metaphysics, it's not that everybody is motivated by that. They're motivated by different things. But that one is very deep for a lot of folks. People should read Nick Land and Nick Bostrom and David Pearce and Kurzweil on this to see who are the philosophers that kind of all of Silicon Valley follows. So there is an argument that whoever gets to AGI first, if AGI takes everything over, I'm not still going to be able to control it, but maybe I can merge with it. Brain-computer interface, orienting towards whole brain emulation. But maybe I can control it. And if I can control it, then whoever gets to AGI first runs everything. So if you look at Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, which is AI applied to intelligence and military capacities, his public talks recently, he says U.S. has to get AGI dominance and then use that capacity to ensure that no one else ever gets it. Now, what that means, like, okay, well, how do you ensure that China doesn't advance? Well, because AGI dominance can turn their nukes off, can turn their banks off, can whatever you need to do, right? So it's actually like an open public call for a global one world government, infinite monopoly of power with no checks and balances on it. Sitting next to Eric Schmidt and, you know, the heads of U.S. military and defense being like, yep, this is the imperative. So there's the idea, if we get to AGI and can control it, we run the world. If we get to AGI and can't control it, at least we have the best shot of knowing how to merge with it. If anybody else gets there first, not only are we losers forever, but we have no say in anything ever again, because the AI will now run everything. So if I care about anything ever, the only play I have is get to AGI first. And whatever I have to harm to get there first is worth it, because then that's the only way I can do stuff. That is kind of an ubiquitous argument. And so why I say the motivated reasoning is everybody who makes that argument argues why it's inevitable we're going to get there. It'll probably be dystopic. Maybe it'll be utopic. But I need to be the one to get there first, because I'll make the least dystopic version for everybody. And it's like, really? Really? Like, why? Everybody's argument is that they're the best ones to do it. Not like, I think that guy is the best qualified. Let me go help that project. Nobody makes that argument. And so you're like, do you believe that yourself? Or is that just the public rhetoric you're giving? That's the motivated reasoning story.
I told your colleague Zach Stein on our podcast that at times like this, I long for just the days of when I was only worried about peak oil. Because what you just described is not a science fiction novel. It's a Stephen King novel. It's in the horror genre.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Nate Hagens with Daniel Schmachtenberger as they talk through Silicon Dreams and Carbon Nightmares. This is a special edition of the Great Simplification Podcast on Radio EcoShock.
I want to get back to the environment and climate change, because that was the focus of why we wanted to unpack this. But let me just ask you a follow-up. In the minds of those AI accelerationist humans who are working on this, what about redwood groves and dolphins and hummingbirds and earthworms and bumblebees and the 10 million species that we share this blue-green earth with?
So if I am being an AI accelerationist saying China is rapidly on its way to AGI dominance and war, we have to get there first or lose, or some other version of that, right? And you bring up that question, depending upon what marketing hat I have on, I could answer it a few different ways. Like, the most true way is all of those things are good sources of atoms that the AI will use to build the things it wants in the future.
Seriously?
So if people have not watched Eliezer Yudkowsky talk about AI risk, Eliezer founded MIRI, Machine Intelligence Research Institute, and I would say has put more time into the topic of AI risk than anyone, is clearest on that. And he says, look, it's not that in most scenarios, the AGI or the ASI superintelligence, it's not that it wants to kill all humans. It just wants to do whatever its objective function is, and it needs atoms to do that. And things happen to be made of atoms. In the same way that most people, when they're relating to those other animals, don't have hatred and vitriol to the redwood trees and the whatever. They just like want wood. They want stuff. And like the trees are made of wood and the animals are made of meat and the nature is made of energy and materials. And so we turn it into the substrate of the we want more.
Whoa. So it's just a higher level scaling of that same dynamic.
you know, ChatGPT has all these guardrails on what it's not allowed to say, and but you can figure out hacks to kind of jailbreak it and get it to say things. And then there are obviously open source ones that are not. So we were playing with it a little while ago and got it to make a bunch of answers about how AI can kill the whole world.